I want you to try something really quickly, right now, wherever you are. Just take a simple deep breath in,
Yeah.
fill your lungs completely, and now just, let it all out.
Right.
It is arguably the most basic automatic thing your body does. I mean, you've been doing it since the moment you were born.
Absolutely.
But imagine if, instead of just blowing that air out into the room, you blew it into a small plastic tube. Suddenly, that one single unremarkable breath can be sliced into thousands of high-resolution data points.
It's wild.
It becomes this mechanical, mathematical blueprint of your entire respiratory system.
We truly do take breathing for granted, but the physical mechanics involved are honestly astonishingly complex. Capturing the nuance of those mechanics, the speed, the volume, the pressure, it requires an equally complex system to just make sense of it all.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. Today, we are looking at the Spirometry Data Output Clinical Interpretation Guide published by BOMAmed. We are going to decode how modern medicine actually reads your breath because, as we found out in these sources, reading lung capacity has moved way past just looking at a raw number on a screen.
Way past it.
We're going to explore this whole world of statistical modeling, geometric curve analysis, and incredibly strict environmental controls.
The evolution of this technology really highlights how clinical practice has to adapt, as our understanding of human physiology deepens. It is no longer just about measuring how much air you move. It's about capturing precisely how and when you move it, and then comparing that performance against a highly sophisticated global reference model.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to appreciate how advanced spirometry is today, we should probably look at the basic metrics first.
Definitely.
And more importantly, why the old way doctors used to interpret those metrics was actually systematically flawed.
Yeah, to establish our baseline, we need to define the primary indices derived during that forced exhale you just had the listener do. The big three we are looking at are FEV1, FVC, and, well, the ratio between those two numbers.
Breaking those down, FEV1 stands for forced expiratory volume in the first second.
Right.
So, literally, how much air you can forcefully push out of your lungs in one single second. The BOMAmed guide notes this is a really sensitive indicator for airway obstruction.
Exactly.
Then we have FVC, which is forced vital capacity. And that is the total volume of air you can exhale during the entire maneuver, right? From full lungs down to completely empty.
Spot on. And if your FVC drops, it usually indicates some sort of lung restriction.
Like your tank is just smaller than it should be.
Yes, exactly. Your physical capacity is restricted. Now, for decades, the cornerstone of diagnosing lung issues was looking at the relationship between those two metrics, the FEV1-FEC ratio.
Right, the ratio.
It helps identify airflow limitations regardless of the actual physical size of a person's lungs. Historically, the medical community used a fixed cutoff ratio for this. If your FEV1-FVC ratio fell below 0.70, you were automatically diagnosed with an obstructive pattern.
I mean, on the surface, I can see why they did that. You want a clear, visible boundary to make diagnosing easier, right?
Right. It's simple.
But thinking about how the human body ages, this fixed 0.70 cutoff feels like setting a single generic one-size-fits-all speed limit for every single vehicle on every single road, regardless of conditions.
That's a great way to put it.
If my lung tissue naturally loses some elasticity as I age, meaning my 80-year-old lungs inherently won't perform like my 18-year-old lungs, wouldn't a fixed threshold automatically flag me as sick eventually just for getting older?
You've zeroed in on a massive systemic problem in historical respiratory medicine. Using that fixed 0.70 cutoff actively caused the overdiagnosis of obstructive diseases like COPD in older adults.
Wow, just because of age.
Yep, their ratio naturally drops below 0.70 simply because of the physiological changes that happen as we age, not because they actually have a disease.
That's frustrating.
And conversely, it was causing the underdiagnosis of younger patients.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a young adult in the early stages of a severe lung disease might still easily score above a 0.70 because their starting capacity was so high, even though their personal baseline is, in free fall.
That is a staggering blind spot. I mean, you're either telling a perfectly healthy grandfather he needs medication or sending a sick young adult home without treatment.
Which is exactly why the modern technical standards, these are governed jointly by the American Thoracic Society and the European Respiratory Society, or AITSRS, have shifted away from fixed cutoffs entirely.
Okay, so what do they use now?
Today, the standard is to use the lower limit of normal, or LLN, which relies on statistical Z-scores.
Oh man, the dreaded Z-score from high school statistics makes a triumphant return.
It does.
For anyone who blocked out that particular math class, a Z-score basically maps out where you sit on a bell curve, right?
That bell curve analogy is perfect. Instead of a hard line, imagine a massive bell curve made up of thousands of healthy people who share your exact demographic traits. The lower limit of normal represents the fifth percentile of that specific healthy reference population.
So the very bottom edge.
Exactly. Mathematically, that corresponds to a Z-score of about -1.64. By interpreting the data through this distribution-based model, the algorithm dynamically adjusts the normal threshold based on your age, your biological sex, your height, and your ethnicity.
So it creates a bespoke threshold just for you.
Yes.
When a diagnostic machine flags your test today, it isn't because you missed some arbitrary global 0.70 mark. It's because your data shows a true physiological abnormality when compared to people with your exact body type and background.
The shift to the LLN model gives doctors a statistically valid confidence level that the limitation they are seeing on the screen is a real disease process rather than just, you know, expected demographic variation.
Knowing our numbers are now mathematically tailored to us is great, but numbers on a spreadsheet only give us the final tally.
Sure.
To really decode what's happening inside the lungs, it seems like we have to look at the actual physical shape of the air leaving the body.
We are moving from pure statistics into visual morphology.
Yeah.
This is where flow volume loops and volume time curves become essential tools for the physician.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Looking at just the raw scalar numbers, the FEV1, the FVC, it's essentially like reading the box score of a baseball game the next morning.
Right.
You know the final outcome. You know who won. But looking at the flow volume loop, that is like watching the high-definition video replay of the batter's swing. You can see exactly how the mechanics broke down in real time.
I love that. The visual data reveals diagnostic signals that scalar numbers simply cannot capture.
Mm-hmm.
The flow volume loop graphs the flow rate of the air against the total volume exhaled and inhaled. It basically maps the mechanical behavior of your airway.
The Baumann guide highlights some very specific visual patterns that pop up on this graph. For example, if the expiratory limb of the curve, the part showing air being blown, outlooks scooped or concave, that instantly signals an airway obstruction like asthma or COPD.
Yeah, and that scooped out shape has a direct mechanical cause. In a patient with an obstructive disease, the small airways are compromised.
Right.
When the patient forcefully exhales, the sheer pressure inside the chest actually causes those small airways to collapse prematurely.
Oh, wow.
The airflow rate plummets dramatically, creating that concave dip on the graph, even while a slow trickle of volume continues to, you know, empty out.
The visual data gets even more specific when we look at the inspiratory limb, the bottom part of the loop showing the patient pulling air back in.
Mm-hmm.
The guide mentions that if this inspiratory limb is flattened out, almost like a plateau, it points to a variable extrathoracic obstruction. Extrathoracic meaning outside the chest cavity.
Mm.
So we're talking about an issue in the throat, right? Like vocal cord dysfunction.
Precisely. Think about the physics of taking a sharp, deep breath in. You're creating negative pressure.
Okay.
If the vocal cords are dysfunctional, that negative pressure actually sucks them together, narrowing the opening.
Yeah.
Yeah. The speed at which you can pull air in hits a hard limit, which translates to a flat line on the bottom of the graph.
That makes total sense.
Alternatively, if both the top and bottom of the loop are flattened, like someone took a rolling pin to the entire graph, that indicates a fixed structural obstruction.
Like a goiter pressing on the windpipe.
Exactly.
It acts like a rigid, narrowed pipe that chokes the airflow equally, whether you're pushing air out or pulling it in.
Right.
It's amazing that a doctor can differentiate between asthma, vocal cord issues, or a structural mass just by looking at the geometry of a curve on a screen.
It's a powerful tool.
But wait, if these shapes tell us about the airway mechanics, what stops a patient from just giving a weak effort? I mean, if I blow into the tube half-heartedly, won't that just draw a tiny abnormal curve?
That introduces the volume time curve,
yeah,
which is all about temporal validation.
Okay.
The machine needs to prove that the maneuver was actually completed properly,
yeah,
before it even bothers analyzing the shape.
Oh, so it checks your homework.
Basically. According to the ATRS criteria, a valid forced exhale must last at least 6 seconds in adults.
6 seconds, that's a long exhale.
It is, or it has to show a clear plateau where absolutely no more air is leaving the body for at least one full second. If the volume time curve shows an abrupt end, the software knows the patient simply stopped trying and the test is invalid.
Which brings us to perhaps the biggest variable in this entire high-tech diagnostic process. We have these advanced statistical Z-scores, we have these complex flow volume geometries, and none of it matters if the patient taking the test messes up.
Effort dependency is the ultimate Achilles heel of spirometry.
Yeah.
A diagnostic grade system can capture flow data at incredibly high resolutions, measuring fractions of a liter per millisecond. But if the patient's physical performance is flawed, that high-resolution data is clinically useless.
The strictness of the ACER's repeatability requirements really underscores that. According to the guide, a patient doesn't just do this once and go home.
No.
They have to provide a minimum of 3 completely acceptable maneuvers during a single testing session.
And acceptable is a very high bar. The software looks for rapid initiation, meaning no hesitation at the start of the breath.
Okay.
You have to sustain the exhale for the full duration without letting up. And then the system compares your 3 attempts against each other to check for variance.
This is the metric that really surprised me. The FEV1 and the FEC numbers must be reproducible within 150 milliliters between your 2 best efforts.
Yep.
150 milliliters. That is roughly the volume of a tiny Dixie cup of water. If your lung capacity varies by more than that tiny cup of air between breaths, the test fails.
Modern spirometry systems essentially act as an automated judge of the patient's performance. There are all sorts of common technical artifacts that patients accidentally introduce.
Like what?
Well, if you cough during that crucial first second of the exhale, the FEV1 metric is completely obliterated.
Right.
If your lips don't form a tight seal and air leaks around the mouthpiece, the total volume is artificially lowered. Or we see variable effort where the patient blows hard, then softens, then blows hard again.
So if I cough during that first second, or if my second breath is 200 milliliters smaller than my first breath because I got slightly distracted, the machine just throws out my data. Is this diagnostic marvel entirely at the mercy of my ability to flawlessly follow instructions?
In a diagnostic setting, yes. Software built for clinical environments, like the systems Barmid provides, uses automated quality grading.
Wow.
If the variance between your breaths is over that 150 milliliter threshold, the machine mathematically recognizes that the result isn't a true reflection of your physiology.
It's just technical noise.
Exactly. It's just noise. Without a verified A or B quality grade, the ACER's standards dictate that the spirometry data simply is not clinically actionable. A physician should not base a diagnosis on it.
It's like the machine is acting as a bouncer for the doctor's medical record. Sorry, your breaths were 160 milliliters apart. You're not getting into the chart today.
Well, the downstream clinical decisions made from this data prescribing lifelong steroid inhalers or clearing someone for a major lung resection surgery, they carry massive weight.
That's true.
The standards have to be draconian to ensure we aren't making life-altering decisions based on a cough or a leaky mouthpiece.
Fair enough. Let's assume I pass the bouncer. I give 3 flawless, reproducible breaths.
Okay.
The curves are clean, and we have a validated test session. Let's say the doctor sees a scooped expiratory curve indicating an obstruction. The next logical step would be figuring out if this lung damage is a permanent fixture or if it can be fixed with medication.
This introduces bronchodilator response testing. The goal is to see if the airway limitation is chemically reversible.
So they give you a bronchodilator inhaler, wait a bit, and have you do the test all over again.
Exactly.
But just like everything else in this guide, simply feeling better isn't enough for the medical record. There are strict mathematical hurdles.
Always.
To prove an obstruction is officially reversible, a patient needs to show an increase in their FEV1 or FEC of at least 12% from their baseline ND, an absolute volume increase of at least 200 milliliters.
That AND is a critical safeguard. Both a relative percentage and the absolute volume criteria must be met simultaneously.
Why both?
Well, let's connect this back to what we just discussed about variance. Imagine a patient with very severe lung disease whose baseline FEV1 is incredibly low, say just 1 liter.
Okay.
If they improve by 12% after using the inhaler, that is an increase of only 120 milliliters.
Oh, I see where this is going. 120 milliliters is less than the 150 milliliter natural variance limit we just talked about.
Precisely the issue. If the criteria only required a 12% increase, the doctor wouldn't know if the medication actually worked or if the patient just happened to blow 120 milliliters harder on that particular attempt due to natural variance.
Wow.
The requirement for a 200 milliliter absolute increase ensures the improvement is well above the threshold of statistical noise. It proves the drug is genuinely dilating the airways.
That is a brilliant safeguard. It prevents false hope. So we've controlled for age, sex, and height with Z-scores. We've controlled for patient effort and statistical noise. But the guide reveals one final invisible variable that doctors have to control for the room itself.
We have to talk about BTPS compensation, which stands for body temperature and pressure saturated.
This is where the physics of breathing really blew my expectations out of the water. The spirometer has to mathematically adjust the measured air to match the physiological conditions inside the patient's lungs.
Right.
I had to pause and think about the mechanics of this. The air inside our lungs is a balmy 98.6 degrees and heavily humidified, but the air outside in the clinic room might be a dry 68 degrees.
Think about how gases react to temperature. Gases expand when they are warm and physically shrink when they cool down.
Okay.
The moment that warm, saturated breath leaves your mouth and hits the sensors of the spirometer, it rapidly cools and the volume physically contracts.
So, if I'm understanding this correctly, if the machine doesn't account for that temperature drop, it will measure the cooled, shrunken air and tell the doctor my lung capacity is significantly smaller than it actually is inside my chest.
Yes. Failure to apply BTPS adjustments introduces immediate systematic errors into the data, particularly for total volume measurements like the FVC.
That's crazy.
And it isn't just temperature. The machine must also account for ambient barometric pressure, which changes based on your altitude and the daily weather.
Wait, the machine literally has to check the local weather and room temperature to diagnose my lungs accurately.
It does, which highlights why calibration is such a massive part of this guide.
Right.
Diagnostic grade systems require rigorous daily calibration routines. The technician must use a standardized 3-liter calibration syringe every single day to verify that the flow sensors haven't drifted.
Okay.
Because if the device sensors drift due to environmental changes and it starts reading a 3-liter injection as 2.8 liters, every single patient evaluated in that clinic that day receives a flawed, artificially low diagnosis.
The guide draws a very sharp distinction here between high-fidelity, diagnostic-grade spirometers, the kind Bombomed builds for hospitals, and lower-tier screening devices.
Very sharp.
A cheap, handheld screening device might not have the sensor precision to do full geometric curve analysis. It might lack automated quality grading, and it might skip these vital daily calibration steps entirely.
A simple screening device is fine for flagging a potential issue, sure, but you cannot use it to confidently track disease progression or make definitive diagnoses.
Right.
When the data is being used to inform critical long-term treatment decisions, you need diagnostic grade capability that neutralizes all of these variables, environmental, technical, and physiological.
Let's take a step back and look at the journey we've just been on. We started with the incredibly simple automatic act of taking a breath.
Yeah.
But we've uncovered a highly standardized, deeply complex hidden world. We've moved from flawed one-size-fits-all ratios to personalized Z-scores on a bell curve. We've learned to read the scooped and flattened geometries of collapsing airways. We've seen how a 150 milliliter variance acts as a bouncer for clinical validity. And we've learned that even the barometric pressure in the room has to be mathematically neutralized.
It represents a phenomenal amount of technical work.
Yeah.
Just to ensure that the data is pure. But we have to remember why this purity matters for you, the listener, in the long term.
Absolutely.
Because of these incredibly strict data standards, this diagnostic data is reliable enough to be integrated directly into your electronic medical records.
The longitudinal tracking, being able to compare apples to apples across decades.
Exactly. Lung disease rarely happens overnight. It progresses over years. When patient effort, room temperature, sensor calibration, and demographic variables are all strictly controlled, a doctor can look at your data from 2026, compare it to your data from 2036, and confidently measure true disease progression. They can differentiate between the expected, normal, age-related loss of lung function and an abnormal, dangerous decline. That level of insight is only possible because the data from both visits was standardized to the exact same rigorous criteria.
It is about building a flawless historical map of your health. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Something this deep dive really brought to the surface for me regarding the data we rely on.
Oh.
We've spent a lot of time discussing how brilliant it is that modern spirometry uses exact statistical Z-scores and global reference populations to find the lower limit of normal. It creates a custom baseline for your demographic.
Right.
But it begs a rather provocative statistical question. What happens to the patients whose unique demographic or ethnic data was historically excluded from those early foundational baseline reference equations? Mm. Before these massive multi-ethnic data sets became the standard, how many people walked out of a clinic with a normal reading that actually wasn't normal for them at all, simply because the medical world statistical model hadn't been tailored to recognize them yet?
That's a great point.
It highlights that even our most objective, mathematically rigorous medical marvels are only as comprehensive as the data sets they are built on.
It is a profound reminder that science and data modeling are always a work in progress, constantly refining themselves as we gather more inclusive information.
Absolutely. So the next time you take a simple deep breath, just remember how much hidden data, physics, and complex geometry is swirling around in there, waiting to be decoded. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and keep questioning the data behind your health.